Chapter 42.
Dear boy and Pip's comrade, I'm not a-going to foretell you my life like a song or a storybook, but to give it to you short and handy, I'll put it at once into a mouthful of English. In jail and out of jail, in jail and out of jail, in jail and out of jail. There, you've got it. That's my life pretty much down to such times as I got shipped off. Arthur Pip stood my friend. I've been done everything to pretty well, except hanged. I've been locked up as much as a silver tea kettle. I've been carted here and carted there, and put out of this town and put out of that town, and stuck in the stocks and whipped and worried and drove. I've no more notion where I was born than you have, if so much. I first became aware of myself down in Essex, a-thieving turnips for my living. Someone had run away from me, a man, a tinker, and he took the fire with him and left me wery cold. I know my name to be Magwitch, christened Abel. How did I know? Much as I know the birds' names in the hedges to be chaffinch, sparrow, thrush. I might have thought it was all lies together, only as the birds' names come out true, I suppose mine did. So far as I could find, there weren't a soul that see young Abel Magwitch with as little on him as in him, but what caught fright at him, and either drove him off or took him up. I was took up, took up, took up, to the extent that I regularly growed up, took up. This is the way it was, and when I was a ragged little creature, as much as to be pitted as ever I see, not that I looked in the glass, for there weren't many insides of furnished houses known to me. I got the name of being hardened. This is a terrible hardened one, they says to prison wizarders picking out me. May be said to live in jails, this boy. Then they looked at me, and I looked at them, and they measured my head, some on. They'd better measured my stomach. And others on give me tracts, what I couldn't read, and made me speeches, what I couldn't understand. They always went on again me about the devil. But what the devil was I to do? I must put something into my stomach, mustn't I? Howsomever, I'm a-getting low, and I know what's due. Here, boy, and Pip's comrade, don't you be afeard of me being low. Tramping, begging, thieving, working sometimes when I could, though that warn't as often as you may think, till you put the question whether you would have been over-ready to give me work yourselves. A bit of a poacher, a bit of a labourer, a bit of a wagoner, a bit of a haymaker, a bit of a hawker, a bit of most things that don't pay and lead to trouble. I got to be a man. A deserting soldier in a traveller's rest, what lay it up to the chin under a lot of taters, learnt me to read, and a travelling giant, what signed his name at a penny a time, learnt me to write. I weren't locked up as often now as formerly, but I wore out my good share of key metal still. At Epsom Races, a matter of over 20 years ago, I got acquainted with a man whose skull I'd crack with this poker, like the claw of a lobster if I got it on this hob. His right name was Compeyson, and that's the man, dear boy, what you see me a-pounding in the ditch, according to what you truly told your comrade arter I was gone last night. He set up for a gentleman, this Compeyson, and he'd been to a public boarding school and had learning. He was a smooth one to talk, and was a dab at the ways of gentlefolks. He was good-looking, too. It was a night afore the great race, when I found him on the heath, in a booth that I'd known on. Him and some more was a-sitting among the tables when I went in, and the landlord, which had a knowledge of me, and was a sporting one, called him out and said, "I think this is a man that might suit you," meaning I was. Compeyson, he looks at me very noticing, and I look at him. He has a watch and a chain and a ring and a breastpin and a handsome suit of clothes. "To judge from appearances, you're out of luck," says Compeyson to me. "Yes, master, and I've never been in it much. I had come out of Kingston jail last on a vagrancy committal. None but what it might have been for something else, but it warn't." "Luck changes," says Compeyson. "Perhaps yours is going to change." I says, "I hope it may be so. There's room." "What can you do?" says Compeyson. "Eat and drink," I says, "if you'll find the materials." Compeyson laughed, looked at me again, very noticing, given me 5 shilling, and appointed me for next night, same place. I went to Comerson next night, same place, and Comerson took me on to be his man and partner. And what was Comerson's business in which we was to go partners? Comerson's business was a swindling, handwriting, forging, stolen banknote passing and such like. All sorts of traps as Comerson could set with his head and keep his own legs out of and get the profits from and let another man in for was Comerson's business. He'd no more heart than an iron file. He was as cold as death, and he had the head of the devil aforementioned. There was another inn with Comerson, as was called Arthur, not as being so christened, but as a surname. He was in a decline, and was a shadow to look at. Him and Comerson had been in a bad thing with a rich lady some years afore, and they'd made a pot of money by it. But Comerson betted and gamed, and he'd a run through the king's taxes. So Arthur was a-dying, and a-dying poor, and with the horrors on him. And Comerson's wife, which Comerson kicked mostly, was a-having pity on him when she could, and Comerson was having pity on nothing and nobody. I might have took a warning by Arthur, but I didn't, and I won't pretend I was particular, for where had been the good on it, dear boy and comrade? So I began with Comerson, and a poor tool I was in his hands. Arthur lived at the top of Comerson's house, over nigh Brentford it was, and Comerson kept a careful account again him for board and lodging, in case he should ever get better to work it out. But Arthur soon settled the account. The second or third time as ever I see him, he come a-tearing down into Comerson's parlour late at night, in only a flannel gown, with his hair all in a sweat, and he says to Comerson's wife, "Sally, she really is upstairs along o' me now, and I can't get rid of her. She's all in white," he says, "with white flowers in her hair, and she's awful mad, and she's got a shroud hanging over her arm, and she says she'll put it on me at 5 in the morning. Says Comerson, "Why, you fool, don't you know she's got a living body? And how should she be up there without coming through the door or in the window and up the stairs?" "I don't know how she's standing there," says Arthur, shivering dreadful with her horrors, "but she's standing in the corner at the foot of the bed, awful mad, and over where her heart's broke. You broke it. There's drops of blood." Comerson spoke hardly, but he was always a coward. "Go up along of this drivelling sick man," he says to his wife, "and Magwitch, lend her a hand, will you?" And he never come nigh himself. Comerson's wife and me took him up to the bed again, and he raved most dreadful. "Hoy, look at her," he cries out. "She's just shaking the shroud at me. Don't you see her? Look at her eyes. Ain't it awful to see her so mad?" "Next," he cries, "she'll put it on me, and then I'm done for. Take it away from her. Take it away." And then he catched hold of us, and kept on a-talking to her and answering of her, till I half believed I see her myself. Comerson's wife, being used to him, give him some liquor to get the horrors off, and by he quieted. "Ah, she's gone. Has her keeper been for her?" he says. "Yes," says Comerson's wife. "Did you tell him to lock and bar her in?" "Yes." "And to take that ugly thing away from her?" "Yes, yes, all right." "You're a good creature," he says. "Don't leave me, whatever you do, and thank you." He rested pretty quiet till it might want a few minutes of 5, and then he starts up with a scream, and screams out, "Here she is! She's got the shroud again! She's unfolding it! She's coming out of the corner! She's coming to the bed! Hold me, both of you, one on each side. Don't let her touch me with it. She missed me that time. Don't let her throw it over my shoulders. Don't let her lift me up to get it round me. She's lifting me up. Keep me down." Then he lifted himself up hard and was dead. Comerson took it easy as a good riddance for both sides. Him and me was soon busy. First he swore me, being ever artful, on my own book, this here little black book, dear boy, what I swore your comrade on. Not to go into things that Comerson planned and I done, which would take a week, I'll simply say to you, dear boy, and Pip's comrade, that that man got me into such nets as made me his black slave. I was always in debt to him, always under his thumb, always a-working, always a-getting into danger. He was younger than me, but he'd got craft, and he'd got learning, and he overmatched me 500 times, and told no mercy. My missus, as I have the hard times with... stop, though. I ain't brought her in.
He looked about him in a confused way, as if he'd lost his place in the book of his remembrance, and he turned his face to the fire and spread his hands broader on his knees and lifted them off and put them on again.
"There ain't no need to go into it," he said, looking round once more. "The time with Cumberson was a most as hard a time as ever I had. That said, all said. Did I tell you as I was tried alone for misdemeanour while with Cumberson?"
I answered no.
"Well," he said, "I was, and got convicted. Esther took up on suspicion that was twice or three times in the 4 or 5 years that it lasted, but evidence was wanting. At last, me and Cumberson was both committed for felony on charge of putting stolen notes in circulation, and there was other charges behind. Cumberson says to me, 'Separate defences, no communication,' and that was all, and I was so miserably poor that I sold all the clothes I had except what hung on my back afore I could get Jaggers. When we were put into the dock, I noticed first of all what a gentleman Cumberson looked, with his curly hair and his black clothes and his white pocket handkerchief, and what a common sort of a wretch I looked. When the prosecution opened and the evidence was put short aforehand, I noticed how heavy it all bore on me and how light on him. When the evidence were given the box, I noticed how it was always me that had come forward and could be swore to, how it was always me that the money had been paid to, how it was always me that had seemed to work the thing and get the profit. But when the defence came on, then I see the plan plainer. For, says the counsellor for Cumberson, 'My lord and gentlemen, here you has afore you, side by side, two persons as your eyes can separate wide. One the younger, well brought up, who will be spoke to as such. One the elder, ill brought up, who will be spoke to as such. One the younger, seldom if ever seen in these here transactions, and only suspected. T'other, the elder, always seen in them, and always with his guilt brought home. Can you doubt if there is but one in it, which is the one, and if there is two in it, which is much the worst one? And such like. And when it come to character, what did Cumberson as had been to school, and what did his schoolfellows as was in this position and in that, and what did him as had been knowed by witnesses in such clubs and societies, and nowt to his disadvantage? And weren't it me as had been tried afore, and as had been knowed up hill and down dale in bridewells and lookups? And when it comes to speech-making, weren't it Cumberson as could speak to him with his face dropping every now and then into his white pocket handkerchief? And with worses in his speech, too. And weren't it me as could only say, 'Gentlemen, this man at my side is a most precious rascal.' And when the verdict come, weren't it Cumberson as was recommended to mercy on account of good character and bad company, and given up all the information he could again me? And weren't it me as got never a word but guilty? And when I says to Cumberson, 'Once out of this court, I'll smash that face of yourn,' ain't it Cumberson as prays the judge to be protected and gets two turnkeys stood betwixt us? And when we're sentenced, ain't it him as gets 7 year and me 14? And ain't it him as the judge is sorry for because he might have done so well? And ain't it me the judge perceives to be an old offender of violent passion, likely to come to worse?"
He had worked himself into a state of great excitement, but he checked it, took two or three short breaths, swallowed as often, and stretching out his hands towards me, said in a reassuring manner,
"I ain't a-going to be low, dear boy."
He had so heated himself that he took out his handkerchief and wiped his face and head and neck and hands before he could go on.
"I said to Cumberson that I'd smash that face of his, and I swore Lord smash mine to do it. We was in the same prison ship, but I couldn't get at him for long, though I tried. At last I come behind him, and I hit him on the cheek to turn him round, and got a smashing one at him when I was seen and seized. The black hole of that ship warn't a strong one to a judge of black holes that could swim and dive. I escaped to the shore, and I was hiding among the graves there, envying them as was in them and all over, when I first see my boy.
He regarded me with a look of affection that made him almost abhorrent to me again, though I had felt great pity for him.
But my boy, I was to give to understand as Compeyson was out on them marshes too. On my soul, I half believed he escaped in his terror to get quit of me, not knowing it was me as had got ashore. I hunted him down. I smashed his face. And now, says I, as the worst thing I can do, caring nothing for myself, I'll drag you back. And I'd have swum off, towing him by his hair, if it had come to that, and I'd got him aboard without the soldiers. Of course, he'd much the best of it to the last. His character was so good. He had escaped when he was made half wild by me and my murderous intentions, and his punishment was light. I was put in irons, brought to trial again, and sent for life. I didn't stop for life, dear boy and Pip's comrade, being here.
He wiped himself again, as he had done before, and then slowly took his tangle of tobacco from his pocket, and plucked his pipe from his buttonhole, and slowly filled it and began to smoke. "Is he dead?" I asked after a silence.
"Is who dead, dear boy?"
"Compeyson."
"He hopes I am. If he's alive, you may be sure."
With a fierce look.
"I never heard no more of him."
Herbert had been writing with his pencil in the cover of a book. He softly pushed the book over to me as Provis stood smoking with his eyes on the fire, and I read in it, "Young Havisham's name was Arthur. Compeyson is the man who professed to be Miss Havisham's lover." I shut the book and nodded slightly to Herbert and put the book by. But we neither of us said anything, and both looked at Provis as he stood smoking by the fire.